To coincide with Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books countdown this September, on the year that made me, we are celebrating Australian authors. And today, our guest is Rosalie Hamm, whose first novel, The Dressmaker, was inspired by events from her own family history and became a bestseller, and then also a multi-actor award-winning film starring Kate Winslet alongside an Aussie cast that reads like a who's who of Australian cinema. In 2026, Rosalie's released her seventh book, her first non-fiction title. And the title is Look After Your Feet, some keen observations on the unexpected advantages and indignities of getting older. In it, Rosalie says she paid homage to her mother and to the generations of women who'd been denied their own minds and thus their own voice, their true lives, by casting them in her novels. Rosalie Hamm, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, you're a country girl, Rosalie, from Jerilderie on the New South Wales-Victorian border. Could you tell us about your family and the town you grew up in?
We're a farming family, or my brothers are at least, and they still have the farm there. And they've been struggling to survive and gradually buying up the farms around them, because that's what you have to do these days in order to keep the banks at bay. But they still farm a few sheep, mostly canola, a bit of rice, wheat, and anything else, depending on what the productivity people decide that's going to make money. And I still like to go home occasionally. One of my brothers lives on the farm, and I go home and stand in a paddock for a while and feel oriented. But it was a very good childhood in lots of regards. You kind of made up rules yourself if you were left to your own devices, I thought. We had so much freedom that one of the things we used to do as kids, we used to go down to the wheat silos, which is an enormous corrugated iron shed. And it was before the days of occupational health and safety. And climb up onto the roof and get into the mechanism of the elevator that brought the wheat up from underneath and drew it up through the middle and then ran it along the apex of the roof and then dropped it in giant mountains of wheat inside this vast shed. And us kids used to run along the escalator and jump off into the wheat. And it's not an unusual activity I've discovered in the last few years, as I often talk about this. But one day I came home, my dad asked me what I'd been doing, and I told him, and he said, "Don't jump into the sorghum, you'll sink to the bottom." And that way of life with the farming, and there were tragedies every harvest, it seemed, somewhere, they kind of stay with you. And so when I wrote my first novel, I used a lot of those things and a lot of characters from the town or portions of them, not necessarily accurate reflections, but as inspirations for all of my writing, really.
Yes, indeed. Many of the things that you've described from your childhood do ring quite a few bells with The Dressmaker. Could you tell us about the real life events and the sort of small town scandal that is at the heart of The Dressmaker, and tell us how much of that is based on your family's story, and what else, beside the risk of asphyxiating in sorghum, is true in The Dressmaker?
When I walked into the novel class, the teacher said, "Write down in 500 words what your novel's going to be about." And we were under the impression that none of our novels would ever get published. This was our first one. This was the catharsis of getting rid of all our tragedies. And it was the second or third novel we'd find out if we had anything to contribute to the canon. I just wrote down an idea that obviously had been sitting with me, but I hadn't consciously dealt with it. And it was about when I was about 8 or 9, I think, my mother had an affair and left the family home. And it was a scandalous thing. And because of that affair, she destroyed quite a few lives and disintegrated the family and all sorts of things, despite the fact that she only went 2 blocks away because the town's very small and you couldn't go far. She was ostracized a little bit by the community for a while, and she became a threat. And someone said to me that their mother had turned around to their father during an argument and said, "You better not upset me, I'll do a Dorothy Hamm." And so that was pretty funny. Those things are forgotten soon enough, or not, in a small community, but they forgot about it and life went on. And my mum had made new friends, people that went to the pub and drank beer and smoked cigarettes. And she joined the drama society and just lived the life that she was meant to live, except she'd made this disastrous marriage, as many people did in those days. You married quite young, and probably if she'd left a bit longer, she might have found someone a little bit more suitable than my bookish, introverted, hardworking, lovely, but emotionally bankrupt father. So I just took that whole idea of being ostracized and married that with the idea of revenge, which is something that's dramatic because it's about the dramatization of the life force of the character working to overcome a situation. And at the end of the course, we sent them off to publishers and then we would compare our rejection letters. But one of my rejection letters said, "This is a publishable novel. You should phone some small independent publishing houses." And I thought, oh, I'll do that. And I did. And the rest, they say, is kind of history. So it was an unusual situation. You don't often get your first novel published, or that's what we were told.
On The Year That Made Me, we are speaking with author Rosalie Hamm. And Rosalie, author as an occupation comes at the end of a long list, indeed a list that you give us in Look After Your Feet. It goes checkout chit, onion harvester, waitress, roustabout, contact lens fitter, age carer, receptionist, electric sandpaper operator and footpath post painter, petrol station driveway attendant, aged carer again, tractor driver, checkout chick again, aged carer, nursing home cook, teacher, and then author. Now, I couldn't possibly ask you to tell us about all of those, but I wonder, in some of the ones that recur, aged carer and nursing, what you took from those experiences in particular into your writing.
What aged care does for you, it gives you a perspective and you understand a lot more than the disadvantaged people that can't do aged care. And I found it a very rewarding thing. The whole idea of these generations of women that married young or their life was interrupted by war or depression or illness or tragedy or, you know, all the sorts of things that went on for our ancestors. That sort of, there's a ripple effect and it carries on down through a family. It affects people till the day they die. And I learned how to be mindful of that, and I learned how to be compassionate, and I learned how to be patient. I looked after, when I was living in London, I looked after a lady, we'll refer to her as Lady M. And she lived in Belgrave Square and she had a title. She was a lady and she had a housekeeper called Ramona, and she had a cleaner, and she had me because she had a hairline fracture of the neck of femur. And I would go and look after Lady M during the day. And in the evening, I was living in a squat in Earl's Court. So the kind of juxtaposition between those two things. And then also going to nursing aid school with women who'd learned to be nurses just after the war or during the war or sometime, and were working ladies, spinsters, and they were mean and horrible. And they taught us by design how to be kind and compassionate because we just didn't want to be like them. And because it was a public hospital, everybody was there. And so the variety in aged care, the people, and aged care is a great equalizer. Lady M was in just as much strife as some of the people, the homeless people that I've looked after over the years.
And Rosalie, Lady M wasn't the only person that you saw during your time in London. Indeed, in Look After Your Feet, you describe that year of 1979-80 as caps the time of my life, but not the year that you've chosen as the year that made you. But tell us about the rest of your time in London.
We just had a perfectly lovely time. And it's not like that now. I went to London with a backpack and $1,000 and I stayed more than a year. There was no phone. I wrote the occasional letter home. It must have been terrifying for my parents. And it was a great group of young people out to see the world. And that is precisely what we did. And you could just go down to the kitchen to get a cup of tea and end up at a party or end up at Land's End or somewhere like that. It was just one of those times. And the Christmas that year, it snowed in London. And so we were all housebound and we just proceeded to have the best Christmas that we've ever had. We travelled a lot. We did a lot. People went to places like Reykjavik to work in the fish factory, or they went to Europe and back, or they went to Saudi Arabia and came back after they'd made some money and needed a drink, and all sorts of things like that. And we would just get in a big van and we went off to Nebworth and we saw Led Zeppelin and Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, Graham Parker, Frank Zappa, Peter Tosh. So in that regard, I don't know how I survived, because quite the time that we had.
Indeed, you describe it as when you learnt to have fun. And that's also where you met the gaucho.
The gaucho.
Rosalie, who was the gaucho?
Oh, the gaucho. I'm still in contact with the gaucho. He lives in Brazil now. But I met the gaucho in London and we fell into a relationship which saw him follow me back to Australia. And then he said, would you like to come to South America? I want to ride my motorcycle from Houston, Texas to Buenos Aires. And I said, sure. And we bought a motorcycle in Los Angeles and we rode it to San Francisco. And then we rode across to Houston and he was able to get work and we lived with some friends of his from South America. And I was relegated to driver. The car I drove was a Celica and the accelerator came from under the bonnet. It was a piece of string that came through the side window. So I drove around America for quite some time when I wasn't on a motorcycle driving this Celica. And then we flew down to Merida in Mexico with a bunch of people. And we stayed there for a while and we looked at Mayan ruins and had a lovely time. And then we went down to Belize. And Belize was a bit of a shock. We couldn't take the motorcycle because it would have been stolen or stripped or rattled to pieces on the roads. So we decided we would hitchhike. It was fairly dangerous. We went out to the Key Corker. And I remember that particularly because they took us to the edge of the reef to do snorkeling. And I snorkeled off the edge of the reef and got to look down into the great depths of the unknown. And then we proceeded to head down towards Buenos Aires where the gaucho's family lived. And we encountered a lot of things. On the bus trip through Belize, you always take it with livestock. You have to fight for your seat because though you've bought your seat, they get the kids on first and the kids' bags or the seat. So you've kind of got to fight off all these children. It's quite terrible. They stopped for everyone. No one was left behind. The buses were always late. Often you had to push start them. And it didn't have a front windscreen. And we were driving through Lake Titicaca and it was absolutely freezing. But anyway, they'd brought an elderly man to put on the bus and they'd brought him in a wheelbarrow and he passed away on that bus trip. I remember that quite distinctly. But then a few days later, I was on a train in some country and somebody had a baby. So I can remember thinking there's a kind of balance to the universe, if you will. And when we finally got to Buenos Aires, I remember driving down the Pampas. There'd been a flood and there were dead animals everywhere, but it was all quite interesting and exotic. I do remember the women marching with their photographs, their disappeared people. There was a lot of them. And I remember the military, if you're standing in a line, they would poke you to line up properly with the end of their AK-47s or whatever those machine guns were. We encountered some drunk guards and they wanted our passports or money. And they assumed I had money and they took my passport and they took all my money and they were lurching around the frontier. And I just glanced out the window and I could see my boyfriend out through the window and he was praying. He had his hands clasped. And then I looked around at the drunk soldiers, all the bullets and the guns on the table around me, my passport, my money, and thought, I need to leave. I just need to get out of here. So I very bravely, when I think back on it now, I just grabbed everything that was mine and ran. And they, of course, were all too drunk. And when I got outside, my boyfriend was standing with the truck door open and the engine was running and we just drove off.
Yes, well, between the threatening soldiers and the Celica with an accelerator on a string, it's amazing that you got back to Australia in one piece, Rosalie. But clearly you did. And then at some point you decided to do a creative writing course.
I did.
Why was that? What stage of life were you at when you made that decision? What drove it? And why didn't you become a playwright?
I was at the crossroads of my life. I'd broken up with the gaucho and that was all amicable and had to happen. One of the things he said to me was, you should do something with your life. And I thought, how dare you? And so I did. I decided I better do something. I can't be a nurse's aide or an aged care or a barmaid for the rest of my life. I should do something with my life. And I was 28 at the time. And so I walked into a careers advisory place and encountered an older lady with glasses around her neck, and she asked me what I would like to do. And I said, I don't know. I'm at the crossroads of my life. I don't know what I want to do. And she said something wonderful. She said, what have you always dreamed of doing? And I said, I always fancied myself as a famous actress. And she said, oh, you need to do drama and literature. You can be a drama teacher. And I went, perfect. And so that is why I enrolled in that course. And I kind of found myself. I found myself without orbiting around a boyfriend or trying to survive in a foreign country. I kind of found the more serious side of myself. I went back to reading. I went back to writing. I always wrote things, but I never thought that they would ever get published or I could ever do anything with them. And I did teaching rounds and went, oh, I can't do this. You have to be a grown-up person to do this. I'm not quite ready. And so I decided I'd be a playwright. But, of course, I ended up being the producer, the director, the casting director, the publicist, the prop and set builder, the psychologist, the financer, all these sorts of things, and dealing with other people and actors in a situation where they're on display and things are at risk. I just didn't really have the heart for. And so someone suggested to me, RMIT, Jenny's her name, she said, you can still have all your characters and all your drama, but they'll all be on a page. You won't have to deal with people. And I thought, yeah, all right. So I enrolled in RMIT and it was 1996. And that is when I started writing The Dressmaker. And that is when everything that had led up to that point, every decision I'd made, every stupid life-risking thing I'd done all came together. And I realized that I had a lot of material and a lot of things that I could say and lots of time, a whole future to do it.
And so, Rosalie Ham, what year have you chosen as the year that made you?
It would be the year 2000 when The Dressmaker was published. And that was both wonderful and terrifying because I realised that people were going to read it, and one of them would be my mother. But she loved it. She thought it was because she's my mother. And so everything I did was wonderful as far as she was concerned. And then film offers started coming in and I had to get serious about them and work with my publishers. But because the film has two main protagonists that don't make it to the end, it took a girl from Jerilderie, New South Wales, that I'd gone to school with, Sue Maslin. She was the one that finally got the job done, despite the fact that the love interest didn't make it to the end. And so that was a wonderful thing.
So the film was produced by Sue Maslin. It was written and directed by Jocelyn Morehouse, who described The Dressmaker as Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven with a sewing machine. I mentioned the stellar Aussie cast. Judy Davis, Hugo Weaving. I mean, it's a who's who. And the who's who includes you, Rosalie.
Indeed. Not as much as I would have liked.
Tell us about your role in The Dressmaker.
Yeah, well, my role in The Dressmaker was to become one of my themes. I went from being badly dressed woman in the crowd to well-dressed woman in the crowd. But the fun of that was that I had a few friends and family too. That was one of the conditions that Sue could make the film, but you know, my friends and family had to try to be extras. And so they were very kind and they went straight to Jerilderie and auditioned people from Jerilderie. We had a lot of fun just watching the actors. It was quite revealing. And watching, you know, Rebecca Gibney and Shane Jacobson and all these people not only thoroughly enjoy themselves, but nail those performances in front of a camera where you can't make a mistake, because if you, they'll have to do it again and it'll cost $1 million every second or something. I don't know. But it's quite the revelation.
So, Rosalie, you've published 6 novels now. Why did you decide to switch to nonfiction for the first time with number 7?
The conversation amongst my peers had altered. And we went from talking about going out for dinner and staying out late and dancing all night and drinking champagne and all those sorts of things that we normally did. And we started talking about our bad glute, L4, L5, plantar fasciitis, our toe, our bunions. Where can I get good shoes that look nice but fit my orthotics? Please, can we go and sit in the part of the restaurant where there are not stools, and can we have a paper menu, not those barcode things? We're happy going to the matinee of the Bob Dylan 80th birthday party. And it was all very, very funny to me. And there was a dearth of information that was good about getting old. It was all gloomy. Apparently we are a problem and we're going to be expensive and a lot of us are going to get Alzheimer's. And this may all be true, but there's something wonderful about being invisible. And so there's all sorts of wonderful things that go with getting old. No guilt. You don't feel guilt when you press the button and stop 6 lanes of traffic. You have to wear a bra anymore because you don't run anymore, because if you run, you fall over and die. You know, all these sorts of things. So I wrote a little book trying to advocate for the upside of aging, and I had a great deal of fun doing it.
And the book is full of that real spirit of fun and aging with still a sharp mind and making the most out of it. But it's also a really poignant and profound account. You approach the subject of loss both before and after death, and you discuss your husband Ian's experiences with Alzheimer's before he passed away. I was struck by the fact, Rosalie, that you write that though it was bleak and sad, you found Ian's death a life-affirming thing.
What happened was, in that process, it takes a while because it is sad and terrible, but you just see the good in people. People naturally respond well. Our grandchildren responded just like human beings. Nobody said you have to be kind. They just were. The family unit became stronger. We kind of worked together. Everybody kept an eye on each other. We found solutions for things. You know, I found when I got married, I lost some of my autonomy, and there were certain things that you relinquish. One of the things was relocating huntsman spiders. I became not in charge of finding petrol or tyres or dealing with plumbers or any of those things. I let all those things go, as you do. So we kind of merged. I like to say mental telepathy developed. We had a very good relationship. And then when Ian started getting sick, each day I would have to, it felt like I had to retake on another task. And so I got very good with a hammer and nail. I got very good with gaffer tape, road works, finding good tyres, football scores, all that sort of stuff. The most important thing, I think, is that when he died, we all knew we'd done our absolute best. Everybody then said farewell to Ian, knowing that he had felt loved and cared for and he was off to somewhere else.
Rosalie, in Look After Your Feet, you write that you find out too late that regrets are what makes life meaningful. So what are your regrets and what do they mean?
Do you know, I don't have any. There's no point. I look back and you say, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, or I wish I shouldn't have done that, or I wish, and you think, oh, I wish I hadn't said that, and you feel terrible and it jolts you awake in the middle of the night. But really all it is it's a part of gaining information and figuring it all out. The irony to that is, as I also say in the book, is that no one wants to know about your wisdom. You just have to let people live their own lives. They've just got to do it on their own, because then you work it all out and then it's too late.
We are counting our way down to the top 100 Australian books on Radio National. Before we finish up, Rosalie, what Aussie books are on your list?
Look, that's really hard. I quite like a book that sits quietly on a shelf waiting for me rather than the next big thing. So there's a couple of my favourite writers. There's Jacinta Halloran, who wrote a brilliant book called Dissection, Mifanui Jones, who's written one called Leap. But if I had to choose, I would say Melissa Lukashenko's, was that too much lip? If I had to choose anything, that would be the one. I found that very, very informative and joyous, that book.
Well, Rosalie, it's been absolutely delightful speaking with you on The Year That Made Me. We always finish up this segment by asking for a piece of music based on your book. I'm half expecting that you might choose the ABC News theme because you nominate that as one of the pieces of music that you probably heard the most in your entire life. But before we get to the ABC News theme, what piece of music have you chosen, Rosalie, and why?
I've got a go-to piece that's appropriate for everything, and it's called The Lark Ascending. People will know it. And it's by Ralph Vaughan Williams. And I think it just takes you from somewhere lovely to somewhere sumptuous and grand.
Rosalie Ham, thank you once again.
Thank you, Julian.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.